It's been an unbelievably busy year for me, and so I'm very rusty with my teaching. I've not taught for more than 1 year, and so please excuse me if I don't make any sense. So I'm teaching this with Param, and my job today is to do a little bit more on the 3+1 formalism, and then next week I will do a little bit of linear perturbation theory and show how these perturbations translate into large-scale structure in the galaxy distribution and the microwave background. But I'm only going to give about 3 lectures, so I won't have time to do that much. So I thought I would begin by just a recap of the 3+1 formalism, which Param has done a lot of stuff with you. And I'll do it from just a slightly different point of view, so hopefully it complements what he's done. Just to remind you of the basic idea that we have a 4-dimensional space-time, 3-space-1-time, and then we want to put coordinate labels on it. And in particular, we want to put a time slicing. We want to define some time slicing of space-time. But we know this time slicing is just an artifact. I mean, it's just because our brains do not work without coordinates. The world works without coordinates, but we don't work without coordinates. So we have to put coordinates on the space-time in order to do any calculations. And so what we do is we imagine that there is time. So there's space and time. And time, these surfaces here are defined by t equals constant. So it's just some line you draw, and you say that line has t equals 10 seconds. Okay? Then I draw another line, I say that's 11 seconds. The next one is 12 seconds, and so on. So these t equals constant surfaces are space-like, which means that any interval within that surface has a positive length squared. And we'll call that surface sigma. So sigma is a space-like surface defined by t equals constant. And then, of course, there are coordinates within that surface. There's x1, x2, and I can't draw the x3 because I only have, I've got too few dimensions, but x3 is also lying within that space-like surface. So this is called a foliation of space-time, okay, which comes from the Latin word folium, which is a leaf or a sheet. Okay, so when you foliate space-time, you just fill it up with these sheets, and each sheet defines a constant time hypersurface, 3-dimensional constant time surface, which is a space-like manifold. Now, we're assuming that we had some metric G mu nu in the 4D space-time. And so a natural question is to ask, what's the metric on the space-like hypersurface? And there's an obvious one, which is the metric induced from the 4-dimensional metric. So just measure distances with that, but choose all your, only consider points which lie within sigma, and just use that metric. And so then your length squared is d mu nu. It's just this normal thing, but dt equals 0. So I'm going to consider some interval, but both points have to live in sigma. So dt is 0. The difference between them in time is 0. And so this, of course, is just gij dx I dxj. And that we will define to be hij dxi dxj. Okay, this is the induced metric on sigma. In other words, if I write this out at every time hij of t and x, the metric on sigma, where sigma is the surface at time t, is just equal to gij at t at x. Okay, so that's going to be our first equation. So that looks kind of obvious, that the spatial metric is just the spatial components of the this metric. So I'm assuming this notation that mu is 0, 1, 2, 3, right? And I goes from 1, 2, 3. So Latin indices go over 1, 2, 3. Mu goes from 0, 1, 2, 3. And I'm going to slavishly follow all the notation in Bardeen's article, which I assume you've all seen, even though it's terrible notation. Okay. And so, for example, we learned in the colloquium on Wednesday that Bardeen defined his Newtonian potential with the wrong sign. And I don't know if any of you were there, but it's quite funny. So his phi is actually minus the Newtonian potential. And this actually led to mistakes in the literature because people calculated the skewness of the CMB, the three-point function, and they actually claimed the wrong sign. And it all traced back to this convention Bardeen uses, but never mind. Now, the second point is we're going to have, at every point of this surface, we're going to be interested in tensors. Okay, so tensors are objects which live in the tangent space to a manifold. They have indices which lie tangent to the manifold. And so in particular, we want to consider a normal vector. So the normal vector, of course, is defined so that it's perpendicular to any interval within sigma. Okay? So if I write that out, I would say the normal vector, so four vector, n mu, and it's defined so that n mu, and here I've lowered the index using g mu nu, delta x mu equals 0 for all delta x mu in sigma. And by that I mean that the two points that you are differencing to construct this interval delta x mu are both in sigma. So in particular, the delta x I, so in particular I can choose delta x, e.g., delta x1 not equals 0, and the others 0, and that shows me that n sub 1 must be 0. Okay, and do that for n sub 2 and n sub 3, and so what this implies is that ni equals 0. The normal vector with lowered spatial indices has no spatial components, and so n mu, the normal vector with four indices, is minus n, where that's just some value, 0. Okay, so the spatial, I've just proven the spatial parts of it have to be 0. The time component I'm defining to be minus n. Okay, the reason for the minus sign here is we want the vector with raised indices to be we want n naught to be positive, i.e. n mu to be future pointing. Okay, so in this diagram I showed n mu pointing that way to the positive time direction, and that means that the lowered index must be because g to go from the lowered one to the raised one, you're going to use g naught naught, and that will be negative. Okay, so we just compensate for that minus sign by making the lowered one negative. Now, the second thing about this normal vector is we'll normalize it, n mu, and that means that n mu should have unit length. So g mu nu, n mu, n nu should be minus 1. And again, because it's a time-like vector, and g naught naught will be negative, the length of n mu should be negative. But straight away, I can now read off, you see, from this equation and this equation, of course, I can rewrite this like this. Raising and lowering indices doesn't change anything. So this equals that. But I know this object with lowered indices. It just has a value in the time direction. The only non-zero value is this. Is in the time direction, so I get g naught naught. And so from this, I can tell that g naught naught is minus 1, is minus n to the minus 2. OK, so that's equation 2. Now, what about the other components of n mu? So let n with a raised index be equal to some other capital N divided by n. And the reason I do that is that the 4 vector with the raised index is 1 over n, 1 ni. Okay, so I'm just pulling a 1 over n factor outside. But, of course, this is equal to g with a raised index, g mu nu n nu. Okay, so in other words, by defining n with a raised index to be this way, actually, I can determine what g I0 is. Because the only non-zero component of that vector has a 0 here. So this is g mu 0, n 0, mu 0, n 0. OK, and so here I can read off that ni over n, that's this equation with the index I, is equal to g I 0. And then n 0 is minus n. And so what I have is that gi0 is minus ni over n squared. And so we'll call that equation 3. And that turns out to be basically that, because you see, well, we had this equation that gij is hij, the metric on sigma, and then I have these other two equations for the metric with raised indices. The question is, can I solve these equations to figure out what g is? So I've got two equations for g with raised indices and one equation with lowered indices. Okay? So how would you advise solving for g? It's any equation I can use which might give me, yeah.
So you can calculate from the definition of h that h is g plus n with, or n with lowered, n with lowered. So it seems like you should be able to.
No. That's an inch. G with lowered indices is an inch.
I feel like we're using different definitions of G.
Well, it's GIJ, not G.
Okay, right.
It's GIJ. Okay, so what you know about G with raised and lowered indices is that G with raised indices times G with lowered indices is delta alpha delta, right? Just the inverse. So I know two components, or actually four components, of the inverse. and I know these are, I guess, six components of the matrix, how do I figure everything out? Well, just write this out in components. So G0i plus G0j, Gji equals 0. So this is, here I'm just taking 0i components of this equation. Okay, so the right-hand side is 0. The left-hand side, I sum over the betas. Now, I know these guys because I know G inverse, and I know G 0, 0 inverse. So from this, and I know G with downstairs indices, so from this I can figure out G 0 I with downstairs indices. And all you get is minus N I. Okay, because this will give me a minus 1 over N squared. And so take this to the right-hand side, multiply it by N squared. So I've got N squared times G0j, which will give me a minus Ni. And then Gij is h. And so I just take that N with a raised index there, and I lower it. Okay, so Ni, by definition, is Hij Nj. Okay, so we've now figured out the three downstairs components. And then let's take this equation with 0, 0. Okay, and so here I'll get G 0, 0, G 0, 0 plus G 0, J, G J 0. And that now it's equal to 1, because delta 0, 0 is 1. And so this gives me G 0, 0. So I know everything in this equation now, apart from G with two downstairs zeros. Okay, so this gives me G 0, 0. Here again, this is minus 1 over N squared. So I multiply through by N squared. And that'll give me a minus N squared. So I get minus N squared. And then when I multiply G 0, J, by GJ0, which is over there, I will get NI, NI. Okay, the minus signs cancel, divided by N squared, but the N squared is canceled when I multiply through by this, the N squared from here. So I get plus NI, NI. Okay, so that's everything. And so now we can write G mu nu is equal to minus n squared plus n I n I. And then over here, minus n I minus n I. And then this is h I j. And then to obtain G with upstairs indices, G mu nu with upstairs indices, you just have to invert that matrix, which actually is not difficult because I think we could afford a blackboard duster. Oh, there's one. What?
Okay. I'm using a scouring pad on the blackboard. That's a good idea.
Okay. Okay, so it's not hard to invert that matrix. The reason is what makes it easy to invert is that the determinant of G, if you work out the determinant of the matrix in this form, then it's actually minus n squared bit h. And I'll just leave that as an exercise. Okay, so try it for a 2x2 matrix and 3x3 and so on. And what you'll find is that the Ni actually disappears from the determinant. And so if you want to work out the inverse of a matrix, you can work out the determinant and then use Cramer's rule, the transpose of the matrix of cofactors divided by the determinant. Okay, so That's the sort of starting point of the 3 plus 1 formalism. And so what it does is it takes the 10 components of the metric, and by introducing this completely artificial time slicing, or foliation of space-time, it splits up those 10 components into 6 components of the spatial metric. And so now I can think of my surface sigma as evolving in time, right? So as time progresses, I have hij of t and x. So give me a g mu nu for all space-time, I can think of my 3 metric, the geometry of sigma, evolving. Because this equation is valid for all time. Okay, there was not just one time choice here, it's for all time. And then I have these functions. This is called the lapse. Sorry, that's called the shift function. And the n is called the lapse. So shift is ni, and the lapse is n. And so ni is obviously a 3 vector on sigma. It's a 3 component, a 3 index vector on defined on sigma, and n is a scalar. So this is a vector on sigma, and this is a scalar on sigma. Okay, so 6 plus 3 plus 1 is 10. So you've split up the 10 components in that way. Now, it's also very natural to discuss the curvature of sigma. Okay, so it's some surface, and it has a curvature. Now, one curvature is obviously the intrinsic curvature. I just go away and get hij and regard t as a parameter, essentially ignore it, and just compute the Christoffel symbols and the Ricci-Riemann tensor and Riemann tensor of that metric. And so that will define the intrinsic curvature. So the intrinsic. And you have an extrinsic. And so the extrinsic is the one you're not used to. Or before this course, you probably weren't used to it. And the extrinsic curvature is gotten from the gradient of the normal. Okay, so you think about the surface, and the normal is obviously changing as you run along the surface. And it's that change in the normal vector that defines the extrinsic curvature of the surface. And so more precisely what you do, this is a tensor in 4D, and we want to get out of that some tensor that lives in 3D. Okay, so we need to project it. Project to 3D. And what we do is any tensor, or any tensor index, let's say we have T, mu, alpha, beta, dot, dot, dot. That's a 4D index, but I can always project that 4D index into a part along T, along N, can be projected into a piece along N, N mu, and a piece perpendicular to n mu. And so to project along n mu, this is easy. You just contract with that index. Okay. But to project perpendicular to n mu, you need a projection tensor. And that projection tensor is just this. So it's 1 plus n mu. And the properties of this is that p mu nu n mu equals 0. That's obvious because this just gives n back. That gives minus 1 times n. And secondly, p mu nu p nu alpha is p mu alpha. So for any projection matrix, it has to satisfy p squared equals p. So you can just project as many times as you like, and you get the same thing back. So we define k alpha beta, the extrinsic curvature. I'm running out of chalk. Is there any more chalk anywhere? This is called the extrinsic curvature, also called the second fundamental form. And that is defined to be the derivative, the 4D derivative of the normal projected into the surface. So that is P alpha mu P beta nu d mu n nu. And give Bardeen a chance to pick a counterintuitive sign, and he will do it. And so he puts a minus there. Okay? So for example, this means that the expansion rate of the universe will be minus the Hubble constant. Okay. That minus sign. But I'm going to stick slavishly to his signs. And then this is an easy exercise to see that, in fact, you can drop the second P because beta. You see, because this P has two pieces, the delta and the n's. Now, the delta part of it will just give this term. But the n part of it, you've got n squared equals minus 1. And so take the covariant derivative of this, you get n nu d beta n nu, factor of 2. If I differentiate the covariant derivative of n squared, I get this, because I can differentiate one n or the other n, and that must be 0. And that's exactly the term that comes from the nn part of this p. So in fact, that's just identically 0 if n squared is 1, is minus 1. So that's, in fact, the definition of k alpha beta. And as we'll see in a moment, the sort of interpretation of k alpha beta is that kij goes like hij dot or d by dt of hij. And so you have the 3 metric on every surface, and then the k is just the time derivative of the 3 metric. And so this means the 3 plus 1 formalism is kind of beautiful for Hamiltonian formulation of general relativity, because the momentum, if hij is your coordinate, hij dot will be the momentum. And so this kij is the momentum conjugate to the metric. So we'll see that in a moment. Right. Now, my task in the next half hour, I guess, is to work out the equations for stress energy conservation in 3 plus 1 form. Okay, so I think Parham has done the Einstein equations. and my job is to do these equations. Now, of course, these equations are implied by the Einstein equations. So because the Einstein equations just look like this, right? And then you have the Bianchi identity that d mu g, let's do them with upraised indices. Okay, so that the Bianchi identity is just an identity. So for any metric, it's true. And that implies that if the Einstein equations are true, then d mu t mu equals 0. So these are not new equations at all. You could just take the equations param derived and differentiate them. And you have to get these equations. Okay? But it's messy. And so for many purposes, it's easier just to calculate this thing directly and use it. It's a valid set of equations, so that's perfectly fine to do. So it's my job to work these things out. And let me see. I think I have my projection tensor somewhere. Ah, yes. Yes, so let me say a little bit more about the P. We're going to use P to define, or to, let's say, decompose T mu nu, that's the total stress energy tensor, into, we'll use P and N, N and P, to decompose T mu nu into the energy density E. Now that's again awful notation. Energy density is normally rho, okay? Bardeen calls the energy density E, okay, for some strange reason. But that's what he does. And then we have the momentum density. So this is usually rho, called rho. Momentum density, which will be J. And so that's the quantity when you, it's a quantity with an index. And when you integrate it over space, it will give you the momentum. And then we will have the spatial stress, and this will be S. Okay, so how do you do that? Well, that's rather easy. So the energy is just the projection of T mu nu in both indices along the normal vector. Okay, so that's the analog of T naught naught. The spatial part, the spatial momentum density, in fact, let's call this the spatial momentum density, J alpha, because its index is perpendicular to N. And so the way I do that is I define it this way, P beta gamma, and I need that to be gamma. Okay, so why do I do that? Well, I'm just operating with N on one index, so I can think of that as T naught, and then I'm operating with P on the other index. So I'm projecting one index in the normal direction and the other index in the spatial direction. The reason for the minus sign is the same old thing, that this N lowered is negative, and I want a minus sign to compensate for that. So this is really like T0i. and it will be when we make some particular coordinate choices. And then I'll define my spatial stresses to be just project both indices onto sigma. Okay, so what do you notice about these quantities? They're obviously tensors. Okay, everything I've done here is covariant. So these are tensors. This is a scalar. So this is a scalar. This is a four vector, and that's a four tensor. But it's a four vector which is perpendicular to n, and this one as well, a four tensor perpendicular to n, n alpha or n beta. Okay, so again, we have decomposed our t mu nu, just like we did for the metric. We've decomposed t mu nu into 10 quantities, which one of which is like a t naught naught, one of which is like a t, three of which is like a t naught I. And there are really only three quantities here because they're perpendicular to this vector, and six quantities, which are like the spatial components of T. You can work out easily what P mu nu is using the formulae we've given. So P mu nu is delta mu nu plus n mu n nu. And so from this you see that P 0, 0, you see this n sub nu only has one component. It was minus n in the time component. And so that'll give me minus n. This guy was 1 over n squared, 1 over n, minus was 1 over n. And so this product here gives me minus 1, 1 minus 1, which is 0. So P has no time component. Pi 0. You can work out easily enough, is minus ni, and p0i is 0, and pij is delta ij. Okay, so basically P is exactly what you would think of naively, except for this ni piece. So naively, P is just a 3x3 identity matrix, which just takes any four vector and sticks it into the three components. The only non-trivial piece of the P is this ni. And so you can easily just substitute these formulae in here and read off exactly what the different components of E and so, for example, we see that E is equal to n squared t naught naught, and we have ji, the spatial part of j, will turn is just n t naught I, and the spatial parts of S are just Tij. So those are the formulae which Budin gives. Okay, so now I want to calculate this equation. And, you know, frankly, it's a mess. And so rather than do it blindly, I'm going to use a trick which enables me to calculate it much more simply. And that's just to use a particular coordinate system. So let's define time orthogonal coordinates Okay, to simplify the calculation, okay, so in GR, as I said, the only way we ever do calculations is to use coordinates. And it makes sense to use the simplest coordinates for any particular calculation that you can. And often you can actually choose some coordinates, do the calculation, and then restore the full answer in any coordinate system. And that's what we'll do. So essentially, you do the coordinate transformation before you do the calculation to this particular set of coordinates, do the calculation, and then undo the coordinate system to the general system of coordinates. And then you'll recover the general answer. There's nothing wrong with doing that. And OK, so what is time? What are time orthogonal coordinates? Well, first of all, just ask, what is time? OK, so time is a global function on space-time. Right? In fact, any global function, pick any function you like, okay, which increases monotonically. Well, let's see. Which is, I think, just increases. Which is always increasing, in all future pointing directions. Okay, so here's my spacetime. Okay, some curved four-dimensional spacetime. What this is saying, that at every point, every space-time point, I can draw the light cone. That's a coordinate invariant notion, right? The light cone is defined by light rays which travel out of that point. And for any directions within that future pointing light cone, the derivative of the time should be positive. Okay, so I can think of this as surface T equals T1, and then there's some other surface here, T equals T2, and so on. And what I demand is that the derivative, so T is a function of x mu, and what I demand is that if I contract that with any vector which is future pointing, d by dx mu, t is positive. Okay, where v mu lies inside, v mu inside future light cone. Okay, so this is very general, and I can pick any such function, and that will define the time on the manifold. The level sets of t, in other words, where t equals to some number, those are equal to the spatial hypersurfaces. Sigma. But now it's kind of obvious that I could choose to label these spatial hypersurfaces in such a way that that when I follow the gradient of the time, the gradient of the time is a vector on the space-time, and when I follow that gradient, if I start at a point labeled by x, say x1, x2, x3, follow the gradient, I should reach another point labeled by the same x1, x2, x3. Okay, that will be a way of defining coordinates, spatial coordinates on every surface. So you pick the spatial coordinates on one surface, anything you like, okay, And then you just follow the flow of the gradient of t, and that will take you to all the other surfaces. Okay, so in more detail, so the follow the flow defined by the gradient of t, and to construct a labeling of this, of all the spatial slices. So that's one way of doing it, and it has the nice property that G0i will be zero. Okay, if you follow any time, this is a time orthogonal, so this is time orthogonal slicing. So what does that mean? It means I start at some point, I construct a curve, x mu of lambda, lambda some parameter along the curve, doesn't matter what it is, and I construct my x mu of lambda by this equation, minus g mu nu d by dx nu of t. And so that's just taking the gradient of t, make it into a vector with the metric, set that equal to dx d lambda, and then solve this differential equation for x of lambda. And that will flow me through the space-time along a particular curve. And then lambda, the time coordinate, is lambda, or any function of lambda of it, any monotonic function of it. You don't want time to go backwards. And then the spatial coordinates, coords, are the initial coordinates. Coords on some particular sigma. Okay, so what's the point of all that? Well, the point of all this is that delta x mu, in fact, sorry, I'm being silly here. The time coordinate is just t. Time coordinate is t. So, yeah, think about this as a contour map. The t is the height function on the contour map, and I'm rolling downhill, and as I, or actually uphill, because time is increasing. So I'm rolling uphill, and as I go, t is monotonically increasing, and but I stay, when I just follow the gradient, then I my spatial coordinates are just my initial spatial coordinates on the first slice I started. So if I define it this way, then delta x mu d by dx mu t is equal to zero. So if delta x mu is in a t equals constant surface, okay, so that just the fact that t is constant on the surface means that if I travel delta x in that surface, then obviously delta x times the gradient must be zero because t is constant. And so this means that delta x mu dx mu d lambda g mu nu equals zero from this equation. And so what you see here, so delta x, if it's in the surface, then t is not changing, only x is changing. So this can be any one of the spatial directions. T is changing along the curve. And so this is non-zero. So what it shows you is that gi0 equals 0. Okay. So in this time orthogonal coordinate system, or the coordinate system I defined, g0i is 0. And so that means that ni equals 0 in this this slicing. And so this means that the only non-zero components of P mu nu, okay, in this in time orthogonal coordinates, the only non-zero components of P mu nu are Pij, which is delta ij, and of the only non-zero components of K mu nu are Kij. See, anything that lives in sigma now only has non-zero components, which are I and j in this coordinate system. And so this is minus di n j. And this is minus di partial d by dx I n j plus Christoffel symbol I j k in alpha n alpha. Okay, so here's a tricky point, that when you work out the spatial indices of this covariant derivative, it looks like, remember, nj is 0. Okay, but nevertheless, the derivative is not 0. Why? Because I should work out the full object before I set the indices equal to I and j. Okay, so work out the full covariant derivative, which involves this contraction over the 4D indices, and only then set the indices equal to I and j. So even though this is 0, because ni is 0, so ni is 0. Okay, so even though this quantity is 0, its covariant derivative is not 0. Okay. Because there is this term, and the only non-zero part of it is this. And so that gives you minus 1/2 hij, comma 0. This gamma involves the g 0, 0 upstairs, which is n to the minus 2 minus n to the minus 2. And n0 is, of course, minus n. But when I work out the gamma, there are three terms in it. And the only term that's non-zero is the last one, the gji, comma 0, which gives you this. So that justifies my earlier statement, that kij is basically the time derivative of the three metric. And the trace of K is hij kij, and so that's equal to minus hij dinj, and so that's equal to minus 1/2 hij comma 0 hij n inverse. And so this is equal to minus 1 over the determinant of h, 1 over n d by dt of the determinant of h. Okay, so if you have this is just a basic matrix identity, that the derivative of the determinant is equal to the derivative of the matrix times the matrix inverse. And this you can think of as d minus volume, the volume of space-time, the volume is the integral d3x root h. Okay, that's the volume of a certain piece of the space-time. If I pick out a piece of the space-time labeled by these coordinates x, and I integrate d3x times root h, that is the volume. And so this is just d by d volume of the proper time, because the proper time is n dt divided by the volume. So k, the trace of, so this is actually defined to be k. So k equals minus 1 over vol d by d proper time of the volume. So it's just the rate of change of the volume with respect to proper time. And in FRW cosmology, this turns out to be minus 3 times the Hubble constant. Okay, so now we're basically set to do our stress energy conservation equation. And I'm going to do it in various forms that make the answer easy. So I'm going to choose these time orthogonal coordinates where I can forget all about the NIs. And my metric looks really easy, right? The metric is just g mu nu is whatever it was, minus m squared in here, 0 in these components, hij over here. And I will work out d mu, t mu, nu with a metric like that, and then relate it to the various formulae I gave you for E, J, and S. So I guess the first thing to do is to work out the Christoffel symbols for a metric like that. So we've got G00 is minus n squared. G00 is minus n to the minus 2. Gij is hij. And Gij is hij. Upstairs. So then I work out my Christoffel symbols, gamma 0, 0, 0. This turns out to be n dot over n. Okay, so I think I won't do this in real time. I'll just tell you the result. There's absolutely nothing difficult here. Din over n, gamma 0 ij. Is minus, this turns out to be, so this guy is going to give me a hij comma 0, right? Because I'm working out the 4D Christoffel symbols of this metric. So this will have, I'll just do one component, G0, 0, gij comma 0 with a minus sign. And now, gij comma 0 we already know in terms of, so gij is hij, and I know hij comma 0 in terms of kij. So this turns out to be just minus kijn inverse. And then we have gamma 0 ij, this is minus kijn. And then, of course, we have ijk. If all these indices are in sigma, then that's just the 3D Christoffel symbol of the 3 metric, because all the derivatives are just the spatial derivatives. And there's one final one, gamma i00, which is n comma i. with a raised index. Okay, so now we can work out that stress energy conservation equation. So I've got T00 semicolon 0 plus T0i semicolon I and this is equal to T00 comma 0 minus, now when I take this covariant derivative I get, plus, because these are two upstairs indices, so you always plus gamma with an upstairs index, alpha 0 t alpha 0 plus gamma 0 0 alpha t 0 alpha. That's big. Just taking into account these two indices, and in this term I get T0i comma I plus gamma 0 alpha I T alpha I plus gamma alpha I T alpha T0 alpha. Okay, and then I basically just write out all those terms. So this is just T00, 0 plus 2 gamma 000 T00 plus 3 gamma 0i 0 T0i plus T0i, comma I. Plus gamma 0 I j t I j plus gamma I 0 t 0 0 plus gamma I j I t j t 0 j. So where did these come from? This gamma 0 0 t 0 0, there's one of them, there's two of them, that's this term. Gamma 0 I 0 T I 0, one of them. There's another one here, and there's another one here. 0 0 I T 0 I, so that makes 3. And so just add all these terms up. And now we use the definitions. T 0 0 is n squared t 0 0 is e n t 0 I is j and t I j is s I j. And basically just plug all these results in, and what you will end up with is e dot equals n K E. Okay, so this is giving me the E, that's a K, minus 1 over N covariant N squared J I plus okay, so the Sij is just Tij, the gamma 0ij is just Kij, I gave that term. This term comes from the covariant derivative of T0i, combine it with this guy to make it into a covariant derivative. There's some extra terms here involving n comma I when you their effect is to introduce this n squared. And so that's the result in this particular coordinate system. Okay, this is in a coordinate system with ni equals 0. So now the question is, how do I go back to a general coordinate system in which this is not 0? And the answer is very simple. You see, basically, all of this stuff is covariant anyway, because it involves contracted indices within sigma. The only quantity in this equation which is not, and E is a scalar, and K is a scalar, the only quantity which is not a coordinate scalar in this equation is E dot. So all we have to do is to fix that up, to say what, in a general, what quantity in a general coordinate system would reduce to E dot in this particular coordinate system. Okay? And so that's, so let me just, so how do, so E dot is the only quantity in this equation which isn't a coordinate scalar. Okay, so can you think of some quantity in a general coordinate system which would reduce to E dot in this particular coordinate system? Okay, so how can I construct this quantity? Well, I have E is a scalar, that's fine. I also have N in a general coordinate system. How can I make a scalar out of these two things? How do I make a scalar out of a vector and a scalar? What can I do? What? Or just the derivative will do. Okay, so just differentiate the scalar. A scalar, a derivative of a scalar is a vector, right? But that's actually equal to the ordinary derivative. There are no Christoffel symbols for a scalar. So, so just contract these. So n alpha d alpha e. Okay, so in a general, this is a scalar quantity, which is equal to 1 over n, 1, remember the components of this guy is 1 over n times 1 comma ni. And so this is dt plus ni di e. Okay? Now, this is looking good because if I divide by n here, these n's will disappear and I'll have 1 over n e dot. So I'll have this term. So in other words, this expression will reduce. So if I write this equation, i.e., a scalar equation which reduces to, let's call that star, if this guy is star, in time orthogonal coordinates is 1 over n d by dt, well, in fact, it's just this. It's just n alpha d alpha e equals, so I'll just write it out, 1 over n dt plus n I d I e, which is equal to, and now I can write all those scalar quantities, so that's k e. minus 1 over n squared di n squared j I. Okay, so obviously in time orthogonal, so this is a scalar equation. That's a scalar. Everything on the right is a scalar. But in time orthogonal coordinates, that term's zero. Now, you know that if a tensor equation is correct in one coordinate system, or if a tensor is zero in one coordinate system, it has to be zero in any coordinate system, right? So I've proved that this tensor, namely the tensor obtained by putting all of this stuff on one side of the equation, that tensor is zero in time orthogonal coordinates. So it must be zero in any coordinates. So this equation is valid in any coordinates. Okay? So that's the kind of short way to proving the equation in Bardeen, and this equation is number whatever it is. This equation is number, it's quite early, it's number 11. This is 11. And then the other equation is number 12, the equation for current conservation, and basically you can obtain it in the same way. Okay, any questions? We finished on time, miraculously. Okay, so what we will do on Monday is use these equations, but simplify to some coordinate systems. Okay, so in fact, one of the coordinate systems used in cosmology is called synchronous gauge. It's a special case of time orthogonal coordinates in which n is equal to 1. So you can always choose those coordinates as well. You can do better than time orthogonal by choosing n equals to 1. I didn't want to do that in this derivation because I actually wanted to get the equation valid in any coordinates. Okay, so you don't want to fix the coordinates too much. Just if all you're trying to do is simplify a calculation. So we'll study these equations in synchronous coordinates, and if there's time, we'll probably also do them in Newtonian, so-called Newtonian gauge, where n is not 1, but various other things simplify. Okay, so I think I'm not going to set any problems. If you want to check these equations, that's enough of a problem. And if you want to derive this one, then you know this will take you a while. It's a little bit more tricky, I should warn you, than this one, because you don't just have the time derivative of a scalar to covariantize. You see, here I had the time derivative of E in my special coordinate system, and then I wanted to covariantize it, and it was rather easy to convert it into a derivative. But for the J equation, you have a vector J, and you have to covariantize J dot, and that's a little bit trickier, and you may have to play around with it a while to find the right quantity, which is a coordinate. In that case, it's got to be a coordinate vector, because the equation is a vector. You've got to find what is the quantity which is a vector which reduces to this in time orthogonal coordinates. And so that's a little bit trickier to do. Okay, so I'll see you Monday.